You're listening to the Table Talk podcast, brought to you by the team at Food Matters Live. Welcome to the podcast that showcases the innovations, the big ideas, and the visionaries in the food industry. We dig deep, we look to the future and the past, and we question everything that we think we know about food. I'm Stephen Gates. I'm a food science writer, a TV presenter, and a gastronaut. Today, we're looking at the crisis in the food industry workforce. In theory, if you're looking for a job in the food and farming sector, there's never been a better time. Last year, the reduction in overseas workers resulted in over 500,000 job vacancies from a workforce of 4 million. And that's right across the sector: food processing, hospitality, logistics, farming, the list goes on. It's great if you're looking for work, but the overall result wasn't so good. Crops left to rot in the fields, tens of thousands of pigs incinerated or rendered due to a lack of workers at meat processing plants, crops not being planted, concerns about the mental health of people in the industry, and disruption to the food supply chain. Now, a parliamentary committee has warned that chronic labour shortages in the sector could lead to further price rises and the UK becoming more dependent on food imports. They've said the workforce is the single biggest factor affecting the sector. So, what can be done about it? Well, with me to look at the problems and hopefully the solutions are two people with knowledge across the food sector. We have Jonathan Kitto, who has more than 20 years' experience in the consumer goods and retail sectors. In 2006, he founded consultancy firm Simply Supply Chain. Hello there, Jonathan.
Hi, Stephen. Great to meet you.
Fantastic to have you. We've also got David Camp, Chief Executive of the Association of Labour Providers, the trade body for businesses that source and supply the workforce for the UK agriculture and food manufacturing sectors. Hello there, David.
Hi, Stephen. Nice to be with you today.
Great to have you as well. So first of all, let's just have a little look at the shortages. I've given a few of the headlines. But where, David, do you see the most significant labour shortages in the food industry?
Stephen, you gave a good summary, and I think it's an honest picture of the shortages which we are seeing at the moment, which are certainly the worst that I've seen in my whole career in the food industry. We have this at a time of the lowest unemployment in a generation. We have no freedom of movement or general low-skilled immigration route, and that is indeed where we are seeing the most significant labour shortages. Around three quarters of food businesses are experiencing shortages of lower and unskilled workers, with getting on for half of those, around 45%, saying those shortages are chronic. And that's not surprising when you gave those figures that Grant Thornton came up with of 500,000 job vacancies in the food sector. That's 1 in 8 job vacancies. We are suffering the biggest level of shortages that we've ever seen.
Now, you're sounding very level-headed about this. I mean, this, in reality, is this as catastrophic as it sounds?
Catastrophic is a big word. The word we use is chronic. There are major shortages that have been going on now for some years. It hasn't just happened overnight, but it's getting worse. And it's getting worse and worse, and without any intervention to address this, we are going to see the decline in the food industry that the Environmental, Food and Rural Affairs Committee have heralded in their most recent report that they issued in April.
Okay, now, Jonathan, a lot of the data we've been looking at has been from last year. What's your sense of changes since then? Have things continued to get worse on the ground, as it were?
Yeah, I think, I guess, two bits. I mean, obviously, there's been the driver crisis, which I appreciate. It's a very specialised area of labour in the build-up to Christmas. But that has largely been solved by higher wages and pulling people that had retired back into the sector. I guess there are two common factors that appear to be driving a change, particularly in the logistics sector. And by that, I mean, if we take warehousing and also then the transport side of things. So, transport, we've got enough people back in to be able to satisfy the demand we have at the moment. But again, once we start coming back through summer and Christmas, we end up with pressures that are likely to strain things. The key piece, and a lot of people have sort of said, yeah, is it Brexit? And the answer is no, it's not Brexit. Was it COVID? Yes, it probably had a big impact with a lot of people actually going home and then not returning subsequently. So that drained a lot of resource. And to pick up on David's point, there are actually some very highly skilled individuals who have gone home from a lot of the warehouses in particular. And by bringing new people in, they've replaced these individuals, but at much lower productivity. So, in fact, you actually need many more hours to be able to get the same throughput. Some of that's actually been masked because of the challenges that David expresses. So within the manufacturing, we've not had necessarily the full availability of product in manufacturing to feed into the warehouses to provide our supermarket shelves. And that's actually constrained the real picture of demand. And even within the warehouses, they've already had to cut back and actually slow demand out. So there is definitely not as much food on our shelves as there could be because of a labourers shortage.
Mm-hmm. And is, I mean, because this is a sort of chronological aspect, you know, it goes back to production in the field and then and the whole sequence of events of the supply chain. David, are we yet to really experience the full impact of these things, or is this kind of where we're going to be from now on?
I don't think we have seen the worst of it yet. Jonathan made a good point about EU workers returning home, and certainly, if you look at the numbers, 5.3 million EU workers have been given settled or pre-settled status, but the ONS statistics show only 3.5 million of them in the UK. So that's a figure of 1.8 million people who could be working in the UK but have decided to remain abroad. Mm. The industry as itself, if you start at the beginning with the growers and the challenges that they've faced in sourcing workers. The numbers this year have been set at 30,000. Already, those have all been used up. There are increasing calls from the industry to release the optional 10,000 that are available this year. And we want those released as soon as possible. Today would be great. Tomorrow would be fine. But we don't want it delayed until June. We don't want it delayed until July. We need those workers now. The additional factor on that is that there is now a premium which has been levied for seasonal workers. The rate has been increased from April to £10.10 per hour per seasonal worker. That's 60 pence above the national minimum wage. And that's the minimum that can be paid to those workers by growers. And so there is a premium for using that service. So there is an additional cost element as well. That, the shortages, the challenges, the late decisions by the government to release it, those have an impact on decisions that growers make about which products they will plant, how much they will plant, whether they will make a profit through what they plant. And therefore, I expect there to be further rationalizations in the product that is being planted. So these decisions made at a national level have an impact on individual farms who reach that point where they decide this is not practical, this is not possible, or it's not profitable.
So, Jonathan, have you seen this happen with the companies that you work with, an actual decision to change the foods themselves that are produced or to change the methods that are used to produce them in response to the lack of workforce?
I think rationalising range, definitely. We've seen that whenever the pressures come on, whether it be availability of the workforce in the factories or shortage of supply chain, and don't forget, we're seeing significant challenges around wheat, sunflower oil, pulp. There are lots of other contributory factors, which means the number of products that are available are likely to be rationed. And that has the benefit further up the supply chain in terms of if there are a fewer number of products to pick, then demand is slightly lower and therefore warehouses are better able to cope. So there is a simplification that is beneficial and likely to persevere. I think it's also, if you then look at the inflationary costs coming through, there's a real concern that as the shelf prices rise, then that will dampen volume. And we don't know quite what demand is going to do to settle that. So there may be some tempering, which may mitigate the challenge, but the labour challenge is not going to go away and, is it, if anything, is going to get worse.
Yeah, yeah. So I mean, presumably for workers in the industry, this ought to be good for them. There are more vacancies, and therefore they should be able to demand higher wages, different conditions. How are conditions in the industry at the moment, David? And how, you know, are workers in the UK rejoicing and going, ha-ha, quid's in?
Well, 3/4 of businesses in our survey say that they have increased wage rates. So yes, that's one of the key responses that businesses have taken to recruit more people. And that's been regarded as one of the most effective ways to address labour shortages. Of course it is. Pay more and attract more workers. So that's one aspect. So yes, there has been a wide-scale increase in pay rates, of course, which knocks on to the inflationary pressures that Jonathan was talking around. The other factor is that the second key area that businesses have been performing and undertaking, and what they say they're doing, is making their places of work a better place to work. And that's a good thing. That's a positive thing. You know, people want to work in a place, in an environment where it's a decent place to work, where they're respected, where they're valued, where they're treated with dignity. And that's really been something that we've seen. We focused on it in our trade association, supporting businesses to do that. And it seems to definitely have been something that the industry has taken up as something that they are in control of themselves, and they can charge of making their own sites and workplaces a better place to work. So yes, that's definitely something we've seen as a way that businesses have responded over the last year, 2 years.
So Jonathan, in the Environment, Food and Rural Affairs Committee report that I mentioned, they quote several people saying that they've never known morale so low, because businesses are responding to labour shortfall by having to get people to work longer hours. I guess, you know, if you can't get enough staff, something's got to take up the slack. And now presumably that can have an impact on your workforce. Are you seeing that?
I think the stresses of the last couple of years, particularly in the warehousing sort of environment, where it's already a very physical job. If you think about the chilled sector, then clearly, again, you're working in a dark, cold environment for 12 hours a day under pressure. It's not the most attractive place to be anyway. Mm. Overtime has always been used to try and flex through the peaks and troughs, but seldom has it probably been used in quite such an extensive way. And the other side of things, I guess, is that, you know, as we said earlier, the driver crisis was resolved by paying people more to make sure they were there and pull largely older people back into driving rather than the new people through. There are new people coming through, and guess what? Those have often come from the transport planning offices or the actual warehouse offices, who have stepped up and therefore created more vacancies in those jobs, which I suppose the ripple down is that you end up with a loss of the lower skilled individuals, either in a position where there's a lot of pressure on them. And particularly at that level, then, you know, 50p an hour is enough to be able to move workplaces for. And it's quite difficult to create a nice environment at that level. The other area where there is a particular challenge is actually the twilight shifts or the evening shifts, night shifts. People have realised through COVID that actually they can have more time at home and spend time with their families. And there are other jobs that they can do which offer more sociable hours. So I think that has put a lot of pressure on. I've talked to retailers and others who are running warehouses where, you know, 50 people on a night shift not turning up isn't unknown. So there are very, very considerable strains on those that are in there, certainly.
And I'm interested, Jonathan, on these strains and stresses, and have there been any surprises? You know, David was talking about improving workspaces and changing the nature of them so that they're more pleasant places to work. Have there been other interesting things that have unfolded from the strains of not having enough workers? Things that have surprised you?
Well, I mean, we've talked about the impact of remote working and everything else. So, yeah, people have had to adapt. They have to find ways. They have to find ways of simplifying what they're doing. So, absolutely, there has to be a focus on working smarter and trying to actually protect and respect individuals where they can, rather than just running them into the ground. Mm. Yeah, the immediate firefighter response of working harder and longer can only be managed for so long before people either keel over or just leave, because it's not a good enough environment. So, yes, lots of companies have spent a huge amount of effort trying to make them better regarded, offering bonuses, offering other incentives to try and create a better environment. But at the end of the day, particularly around the warehousing type thing, it's a hard manual job that it's difficult to soften the edges on, particularly.
Yeah, absolutely. Would you agree with that, David, that it's all very well making a nice space, but frankly, it's about cash, really, for the workers at the end of the day?
It's one of the factors, and it's a key factor. Certainly, to be rewarded, properly rewarded, fairly rewarded for working hard is an essential element of the employment contract. But people work for other reasons. They work because it's a community. It's a community of people pulling together to deliver a common objective. And if you can make a workplace a place where you feel and you are valued, where you're treated with respect, you're listened to, you can contribute what you have to give. You're recognized for that. You have opportunities for progression. There is an understanding that you have a life outside of work, that there can be flexibility built into it, that there are different shift patterns that might be able to be aligned with that work. You can do the number of hours that you want to. You know, some people might want to do more hours, some people might want to do less hours. That there are those little signs of you being valued as an individual and recognized as an individual. It's about being a good employer. It's about people treating people as people. It's about creating that brand around why should someone come in and work for you? Why should they come and stay with you? These are quite old-fashioned concepts. They go back to, you know, the 1950s, 60s, 70s about why people worked for a business and ensuring that those things are in place to attract and retain your workforce.
Hello there, only me. I just want to break into the conversation to say that if you're enjoying this episode, then once it's finished, you might want to check out our series looking at green jobs in the food sector. We have expertise from across the sector exploring green food industry careers. And to find them, just go to foodmatterslive.com and search green jobs. And now back to the chat. Now, let's talk on a grander scale here about the government involvement in this. Do you think the government understands the scale of the problem? In April, the government said, "We fully acknowledge the food and farming industry is facing labour challenges. We continue to work with the sector to mitigate them." Response across the past year has been to point out they are listening, but that the UK has a highly resilient food supply chain. Are these all just fluffy words? Does the government know and care about this? And are they doing anything to help? Jonathan?
Honest answer, yeah. They're definitely listening. I'm not sure they understand what they're listening to. And I've not seen the evidence of very much being practically focused on addressing the key issues. I think, yes, they say we've got a resilient supply chain. But if you go right down to the beginning of that supply chain and you don't have enough crops coming out of the ground, then you're fundamentally straining it. So, I mean, I've seen more pressures put on farmers because of the change to the funding at that level. There's less surety in terms of them placing, you know, picking the right crops, ensuring they get the right level of profit. So I don't think they're addressing the level of fundamental steps that need to be addressed. yeah, fundamentally, they are notional elements trying to address around the edges, but not facing into the severity of the problem.
Yeah. So, David, I would imagine that they would say, well, I've been into my local supermarket. There's loads of food on the shelves. I mean, clearly there isn't a problem. How would you pick holes in that?
Well, I hope they're not determining their strategy based on their trip to the supermarket. Look, I don't feel, and I work with many trade associations and many businesses and many growers, and I don't feel that the industry is being listened to. The EFRA committee were very clear that the industry wasn't being listened to. And yes, the food industry, often overlooked, regarded as Britain's food heroes during the pandemic. And we take for granted that the supermarket shelves are stocked until they're not. And I think everyone can remember how they felt during the pandemic when they walked into their supermarket and things weren't there. And we've never seen that before.
It's destabilizing, isn't it? It's extraordinary impact on people.
You know, that really brings home the importance of food security. And that really brings home having the responsibility to be able to feed yourself. We have a food industry that wants to supply more homegrown, home-produced produce. We want to do that for environmental reasons. We want to do that for the strength and stability of our industry. We want to export more. We want to grow the amount of good quality, high quality food that we can export. We want to work in collaboration with government, with the government departments to deliver that. We're always here. We're always prepared to bring our expert knowledge to work with those government departments. And we just hope one day that they will reach out to us and say, right, we work together.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let's look at some of the potential solutions to these, and let's separate them. First of all, let's look at the short term issues. What can be done to release some of the pressure on the food system and on the food industry? Jonathan, what do you think in the short term first?
The short term simplicity is that, you know, unfortunately, wage inflation is likely to be able to try and deliver the labour hours needed to be able to meet the short term requirements. There aren't many levers other than those welfare levers, and I complete support, David. I suddenly realised I may have come over slightly harshly and not picking up on the welfare elements, and because there, of course, those are there. But there simply aren't the people around to be able to bring into the industry because there are better options or there are better paid options. So, you know, there isn't a magic wand that you can wave and say, we're going to get these people from within the UK.
Yeah.
There may be ways of bringing more people in from outside, but I don't see that as a short-term reaction.
David's 10,000, taking up the optional 10,000, is that going to help much?
You know, as Jonathan said, there are very few available workers. Short term, we can release the 10,000 visas in the seasonal workers scheme. I would ask that the Home Office and DEFRA work with the industry for a real determination of the numbers that are needed. The reason why it's higher is because this year ornamental horticulture was brought in seasonal worker scheme, because every year there is a reduction in EU nationals who return to work within the horticultural sector because there is no new numbers coming through. It can only be those who already have the status. And because there, and Jonathan picked on this, a decline in productivity. We did have 20,000 Ukrainian nationals in horticulture last year. That, of course, is significantly reduced this year. So you have a lot of new people coming in. So productivity will be lower. So you will need more people. So firstly, in seasonal workers, we need more visas. There's a recognition that horticulture is not the only seasonal food industry, and we should be accepting that in other sectors, and obviously seasonal poultry comes to mind, but there's also seasonal in the summer, a significant increase in salad production, barbecue meat production. So you accept that there is a need in other sectors for seasonal workers. A recognition also in the skilled worker visa system that in certain roles in UK fishing, in butchery, in poultry production, that the level of English specified in that is not a requirement, over and above the requirement for the job. So a matching of the language requirement for those jobs into the skilled worker visas. Those are essentially pretty much the only short-term solutions that I can think of. And that was a recognition of the EFRA committee as well.
Okay, well, let's think about the more structural level and the longer term changes. Jonathan, what would you hope that the government would do in the longer term?
It's a good one. The only obvious long-term way is to reduce the amount of manual labour required to perform many tasks. And we bring up the inevitability of artificial intelligence and robotics. But that is clearly a longer-term investment. There's a lot of money going into there. There has in the past been a concern about the number of jobs lost to automated factories. But I think, again, the evidence suggests that actually there are many more higher-skilled jobs that come out of it that are needed to maintain these things. And yeah, if we are going to have a sustained gap between the number of hours we need to be able to perform the task, and we don't have the number of people able to be employed, then that has to be a longer term option. I mean, one stat I picked up was over the Christmas period, the shortage is very much regional as well as divided by the individual sectors. And in Bristol, in warehousing, I think there were less than 100 employable individuals and 1,800 vacancies, which shows the extent of the extremities. Granted, that was around the Christmas period when there was a peak, but it shows that there is a huge gap there, and that is likely to materialise again, assuming demand picks back up through summer and back through Christmas.
So, David, are there other aspects that the sector can do itself? I mean, different ways to recruit, to retrain. I mean, do we need to tackle an image problem? Is it just DOSH? Is it wages? What else can the sector itself do to try and help?
So I'm pleased that the Food and Drink Sector Council Skills and Workforce Group is coming together and has a cross-sectoral representation. And I think that will be an important body to coordinate and collaborate on a medium to longer term strategy for the food industry with regard to workforce and skills. And for this to be the coordinating body that feeds into the food strategy that we are expecting any month, and to be the guide for policy for the UK. That's the first thing. Second, I would want the government to recognise food growing and food manufacture and food distribution as essential and critical industries, as it did during the pandemic. But because of that, to have a strategic and collaborative approach. I think they did a pretty reasonable job around HGV driving. And I'd like to see the same focus that went into that, into food growing and food manufacturing, and the level of attention and priority given to it that we saw in those. So that would be the second thing I would see. And then I think there is more work that the industry can do itself. And we are looking at how we do this at the moment, how we build the skills, the knowledge, the understanding and awareness of how each food business can be as effective as possible in sourcing and recruiting its workers. And once you have them, retaining them. And you do that by being a good place to work, a great place to work. So there is much more the food industry can do around that. And there's nothing more that drives your focus on that and the priority of it when there is a shortage of workers. So there's a real driver for that now.
And Jonathan, I mean, you've been talking about warehousing and how tough the job is and how tough the environment is. I mean, is there any way of changing that and making that different and more appealing?
It's hard to know in the sense that the task itself is unlikely to change. But again, as David said, there is a real skill. I guess if you looked at the logistics sector 10 years ago, it was very, dare I say, basic. And it has evolved into much more of an understanding of supply chain. And rather than just being a cost that appears on somebody's P&L, it's realized that it's an enabler for sales and a vital part of that. So yes, we can definitely attract more people into a number of roles so that we can actually help drive those environments more smartly rather than just treating it as a low-skilled job which just has a need to fill.
Yeah.
So I think there is a huge amount that can be learnt in terms of how to work smarter. We're working with a number of suppliers and retailers to try and understand how we can simplify the transition of product from supplier through the retailers' supply chains so that we actually use less transport and less hours and to make sure that we can simplify it that way. And all of these are being driven by the need to try and mitigate the on-costs that are coming down the line. So in a sense, the imperatives have never been stronger and the ability or the need to collaborate has never been stronger. Somehow we have to get the government to engage in the same way as David said, in terms of the drivers. They put 20 million into infrastructure to try and make the environment of drivers slightly better. We have to look at what incentives there are to be able to put the right structure in to change this industry away from a reliance on purely manual labour and to working smarter.
Yeah. Now, David, you've carried out a survey where you asked members some of these questions, and I wondered what results came from that. You know, are there reasons to be cheerful? Is there optimism, or is it all people banging their heads against the factory wall?
No, there are not. It didn't tell a joyful story. 9 out of 10 labour providers couldn't source all their clients' needs over the last 6 months, and it's the same predicted over the next 6 months as well. 3/4 of food growers and manufacturers experiencing shortage of lower and unskilled workers. Almost half of food businesses reducing and rationalizing their output. And a huge amount of justifiable frustration and anger that these issues are not being taken seriously and are not being addressed by those who have the power and influence to be able to do so. But out of such times, businesses become more resilient. They need to drive improvements. They need to become better places to work. It's positive that we're in a position that has the lowest unemployment that we've seen. That's a good thing, to have low unemployment. That drives employers to be better employers and for the wages of the lowest paid in our society to be paid more. That has consequences. The buyers, the supermarkets need to recognize that, need to increase farm gate prices and the prices paid to manufacturers to recognize those cost increases. That has an impact on food inflation, and it affects the cost of UK produce as opposed to produce that is made in countries where the cost of production is much lower. Perhaps the way in which workers are treated is less than we would want it to be. The conditions they live in, the rates they are paid, those all impact the cost of production, and what we don't want to do is to lose UK production to countries where standards are significantly lower than ours.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. Well, my last question then is really for both of you. You mentioned other countries and how they do things, but are there things that we can learn from other countries? And where do you see the inspiration for what could be done and how to change things for the better? Jonathan, should we look to, is there a country or is there a company who's faced similar problems but managed to solve it?
Without repeating what I've said previously, in a sense, it is around investing in working smarter. Wherever there is a centre of excellence, there is a way of working smarter, building supply chains. I guess the two things that go against that, in a sense, is that we've been used to very extended supply chains working on a just-in-time nature. COVID, followed by the latest challenges in whether it be Russia and China and everywhere else, is proving that extended supply chains are actually problematic. And I don't think we're going to be able to buy our way out of this by importing goods to be able to fill any shortfall within the manufacturing sector. And even if we could get it into the country, can we get it through the warehouses out onto the shelves anyway? So I actually think that we've always been superb at innovating and finding better ways of working and extracting value from our own shorter supply chains. And I'm not aware of anyone doing such a good job that suddenly we would need to copy their model or try and import goods from them, because their cost is so much lower.
Yeah. David, anywhere else that we can get inspiration from to solve these problems?
I think we're pretty good too. I think we are globally leading. I want our seasonal workers scheme to be a model of good practice. And I think we are pretty good. There are areas we can improve upon. There are many of us working together to try and improve in that area. But when I look around the world, I don't see a model in another country of the way that they employ seasonal workers that I think, yeah, we've got a lot to learn from there. There are challenges and there are problems, whether that be in New Zealand, Australia, Spain, Italy, the States, wherever. There are challenges with that area. And I think we're doing a pretty good job there. I think we will continue to see a rise in automation. It's always been a few years away, and it still seems to be a few years away. But we are beginning to see it coming. You are beginning to see in different product types, different growing methods, which lend themselves to greater automation, and I think we will continue to see that. Automation is expensive and it requires a return on investment, and a return on investment depends on your margins. So therefore, branded producers are able to have much higher automation, in my experience, than those who sell under own label. And therefore, we need to introduce money into the supply chain to enable the improvements that we hope to see. Costing more comes with its own challenges. There are no easy solutions here.
Well, we will be eagerly watching to see how this unfolds, because it's pretty crucial for the whole industry. Jonathan Kitto and David Camp, thank you so much for joining me. I hope you enjoyed this episode. If you did, there are hundreds more at foodmatterslive.com. For example, to find our series looking at the many varied careers that are available in the food sector, just go to the site and search Career Conversations. Follow to get every episode freshly delivered to you on Apple, Spotify, Google, or your preferred podcasting platform. And thank you so much for listening.